Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,800 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Richard Estep, author of Monsters, Myths, Legends, and Real Encounters. From the creeping undead thirsting for blood to the giant serpent-like creatures inhabiting lakes, rivers, and seas, Monsters, Myths, Legends, and Real Encounters dives into the unexplained tales and frightening folklore of beasts that inhabit the land, sea, and air. Master storyteller and seasoned paranormal investigator, Richard Estep, shares stories of winged humanoids with glowing red eyes, dragons and devils, werewolves and water horses, chupacabras, tommyknockers, and many more. Richard Estep is author of 30-plus books, many of them in the field of paranormal nonfiction, including Visible Inks, Dark Spirits, Monsters, Demons, and Devils, Ghostly Encounters, Terrifyingly True Hauntings, Serial Killers, The Mind's Message and Mayhem of History's Most Notorious Murderers, and The Serial Killer Next Door, The Double Lives of Notorious Murderers. Richard is a regular columnist for Haunted magazine and has also written for the Journal of Emergency Medical Services. He appears regularly on the TV shows Haunted Case Files, Haunted Hospitals, Paranormal 911, and Paranormal Night Shift. For more information, you can visit his website, which is www.richardestep.net. And that's Richard, E-S-T-E-P.net. And with that, I'd like to welcome Richard to the show. Good day, Richard.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me aboard. I appreciate it.
It is my pleasure. I really enjoyed reading your book. There were some of those monsters or legends that I knew about, but you also really threw in some ones that I'm sure probably a lot of people haven't heard of. So it really makes for good reading.
Well, thank you. I was hoping for a mix of the familiar and the new and different.
Absolutely. Well, you worked. It worked. You did it right. So let's start with, when do you feel that your interest in monsters began?
I mean, I think ever since I was a boy growing up, I've loved monsters. I grew up on classic monster movies, you know, the Universal monster movies, the Wolfman, the Mummy, Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, Invisible Man, those kind of things. And I think that fictional love was then transported over to books. And as soon as I was old enough to get a library card, which I think every kid should have, I was able to check out books like the Usborne Book of Monsters and learn about some of those myths and legends. And from there to Bigfoot books and Loch Ness Monster books. And I am still reading and now writing that kind of stuff at 52.
Wow, that's great. Now, with the multitude of monsters to choose from, how did you go about and select those that you included in your book?
That's the most difficult part of this project, was not what to put in, but what to leave out. Because you could easily write 10 books about monsters, you know. So as you mentioned, I wanted to select, Robert, a group of well-known old favorites, if you will, and try and put some fresh light on those cases like the Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot, the Jersey Devil, you know, a Mothman. And then look at some lesser-known monsters, too, things that perhaps are not as familiar to us here in the Western world, like the Shedipay from India and things of that nature.
Well, you know, it's really entertaining being able to kind of go from one monster to another. So now, the monsters in your book you refer to as cryptids. So can you tell us what that is and what are the characteristics of a cryptid?
Absolutely. I mean, cryptid is just a more acceptable, I think, term for monster these days. When we say monster in the context of some kind of creature, there's an understanding that it's not possibly real. You know, nobody really thinks, for example, that Frankenstein's monster is walking around out there, or that Dracula really lives in a castle in Transylvania, although, of course, there are historical origins for the legend on which Dracula is based. Cryptid is the term given to creatures that some people are convinced do exist, and maybe it may be possible to gather evidence of their existence. So lake monsters, winged humanoids, things of that nature.
Okay. And now the study, cryptozoology, is that, what is that?
Cryptozoology is the term used for those people who go out and try to gather evidence of and study the evidence surrounding the possible existence of cryptids. So anybody that goes out and tries to study Mothman or find Bigfoot tracks or things of that nature might refer to themselves as a cryptozoologist.
Okay. So now you point out, one of the things I also noticed, you pointed out that monsters and evil that they represent can sometimes be hidden behind a human face. And I just thought that was really interesting to point out that, you know, there are human monsters as well.
I think the word monster applies far more accurately to human beings than it ever does to something that shambles, crawls, or lurks in the imagination. Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, do the tales or legends of monsters, do they evolve over time?
They do evolve, they change. And we see this not just in the realm of the monstrous, but also in the realm of UFOs, which is an adjacent subject. So I'm sure you're familiar with the UFO contactees that began, you know, in the early 20th century. Well, I should say midway through the 20th century, men like George Adamski, you know, that said that they contacted these extraterrestrials. And they all said that they lived on the moon or Mars or Venus. And lo and behold, we visited those places and we found that there was nobody home. Then the contactees started changing their story and saying that the extraterrestrials were coming from the outer reaches of the solar system. Well, our probes reached there. Turned out there was nobody home. And so then the stories morphed again, and extraterrestrials would claim to come from the nearest star or from the Pleiades cluster or places we haven't yet reached. So those stories changed as our technology advanced and our grasp changed. With monsters, it's very similar, but we see different variations on themes. So I talk about vampires in this book, and vampires have gone from being this kind of dark and sinister, you know, the classic Dracula image with the cape, and things of that nature, to the hip, trendy vampires of Twilight who sparkle in day and daylight, you know, when the sunlight touches them, they don't melt and burst into flames, they sparkle and twinkle. They've been turned into romantic creatures. And then now we're seeing films like Nosferatu, Robert Eggers' reinterpretation of the story. And again, we have this ghoul, for want of a better term, this inhuman, you know, kind of leech-like monster. So vampires change consistently. It seems like the same concept remains, but the idea gets dusted off and given a facelift every generation or so, sometimes more often. A new reinterpretation.
Yeah, it is interesting, especially with the vampire, you know, how you talked about the bloodthirsty to the romanticized twilight vampires, and Nosferatu, that one scares me.
That was a scary movie.
It is. You make a living as a paramedic and clinical educator for a private ambulance company and hospital system. So how has that role impacted your view and or experience as a paranormal investigator?
I feel that I've done television shows like Haunted Hospitals. I've written books like the Haunted Healthcare books where I kind of get to give my thoughts on where medicine and the paranormal intersect. The tagline for Haunted Hospitals, the show, is every nurse has a ghost story. And it's absolutely true. You know, almost everyone I've met has some kind of experience after working in a hospital. And people are getting more comfortable sharing those, which I think is terrific. It's more socially acceptable to talk about the possibility of life after death. It's also more acceptable to talk about, you know, UFOs and UAPs because it's a front page, you know, news stories now. So I feel that working in the medical field has given me the opportunity to hear a lot of people talk about their ghost stories. And I'm grateful for that opportunity for the past quarter of a century.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because those medical professionals are often right there at the moment of transition. So, I mean, it's one of those times that, you know, happens once in a lifetime for a person, hopefully.
Yes.
And, but nonetheless, it, you know, it does seem that there, if there is going to be any kind of paranormal experience, that that would be a time for it to occur.
It would, and there is a huge amount of anecdotal evidence supporting the fact that something happens quite frequently at the moment of death. This comes from people who have been resuscitated. It comes from family members of those who have been with, you know, the departed. And it also comes from the medical providers that take care of them. So it's something we should not be blind to.
Yeah, I agree. So now one of the items, or one of the monsters that you talk about in the book is Bigfoot or Sasquatch. And I hear that you've gone squatching. Is that correct?
I did. I wanted to try that. I live in Colorado, and there is an area of Colorado, Bailey, up in Adams County, which is known, reputed to be a Bigfoot hotspot. And I was fortunate enough to connect with some experienced investigators who said they would take me along to experience it for myself. And, you know, it's fun collecting monster stories, but nothing quite like doing field work. So lacing up your boots, getting out there into the woods, and coming back to tell the story is, has been one of the delights of writing this project.
Yeah, I can imagine, you know, that when you're kind of out there gathering, you know, information or research material, it has to give that, you know, that personal perspective that you get from doing that really can help you identify with and relate to those who have had the experience or even relate the experience to you.
I think that personal perspective is one that adds value to any kind of creative endeavor. So it was really interesting to get out there, and it's something that I'm still actually looking into. And let's just say I've not written my last word on the subject of Bigfoot.
Well, you know, I am sure with 30 plus books, I'm sure you have a lot to say still. So that's okay. Now, as a paranormal investigator, what are some of the tools that you use in your investigations?
As an investigator, I think the most basic tool is the ability to think critically. And I say that because we lean heavily on gadgets and equipment, but the initial, for want of a better term, ghost hunters, you know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Sir Oliver Lodge, William Crookes, the Victorian era scientists, they did not have electronic devices. So their kit was something as simple as a pen, a pencil, a notebook, maybe some mercury, a thermometer, and an inquiring mindset. So I think starting very basic is the key and not getting overly burdened with technology. Voice recorders, electromagnetic field, monitoring equipment, things of that nature, it all has its place. But in medicine, when we assess the clinical condition of a patient, we don't just rely on one data point. And there is an old saying, treat the patient, not the monitor, meaning the cardiac monitor or the blood pressure reading or whatever. Treat the patient in totality. And that's what we try and do when we investigate claims of paranormal activity. We look at the big picture, of which, you know, the equipment readings are just one part.
Yeah. And I noticed reading through your book that you keep an open mind, you know, and you don't prejudge, and that, you know, like some investigators may meet a story with rolling eyes, that isn't your style.
No, it isn't. I think you have to be open to it. By the same token, you know, you don't want to be too credulous either. You have to look at the evidence, and the fact of the matter is, the real dichotomy of this kind of work is that the least reliable form of evidence in the scientific realm is eyewitness observational evidence. Our eyes fool us all the time. Our senses fool us all the time. And the majority of the so-called evidence for the paranormal, for cryptids, things of that nature, is eyewitness anecdotal evidence. There's no getting around it. It would be so much easier if we had, you know, a Bigfoot carcass to analyze, and we don't. It would be so much easier if we had a tooth of the Loch Ness Monster or something along those lines, but we don't. So it is one of those never-ending gray areas, I think.
Yeah. And you also indicate, too, that what is science fiction or folklore in one particular period of time may ultimately prove to have a valid basis for it.
And it's fair to really make that distinction, simply because when you write a book, and I love that the publisher came up with the title Myths, Legends, and Real Encounters. Real encounters is a subjective term in that we primarily only have the eyewitnesses' words for it. That being said, is everybody that has something like this happen to them making it up or mistaken or delusional? I don't think so. But some of this clearly lies in the waters of myths and legends. I trace the werewolf legends, for example, back to Viking warriors who would dress in wolf pelts in order to terrify their enemies, their victims. You know, so myths and legends are rooted in reality sometimes too, and it's fascinating to explore where those areas transect.
Yeah, I would think that it would be just interesting from a historical and research perspective to get the lineage, I guess, of what a myth or legend may have had.
It is. It's fascinating to trace that back through our cultures and find its roots as best we can.
Yeah. Now, one thing I found interesting is that you indicate that we need our monsters. And I thought, that's interesting. So can you tell us why you feel that we need our monsters?
Absolutely. I feel that monsters have always performed a valuable role throughout human history. For one thing, they've provided us with a way of telling stories, morality. I talk about Krampus in the book. I'm sure you read that chapter. Krampus is a European legend, and essentially it is the dark, frightening, violent half of Father Christmas. You know, the idea that Krampus comes for the naughty children on the night of December the 5th, Krampusnacht, and will take them, will snatch them up and beat them, and then return them the next day, dazed, confused, and hurt. For the sin of not being well behaved. And the good kids get presents from St. Nick, Father Christmas, on December the 25th, Christmas Day. So, you know, this is a monster that has been used, not necessarily in a healthy way, to keep try and keep kids' behavior in line over the generations.
That kind of makes you wonder sometimes, you know, what were methods used by parents for trying to keep their children in line.
Absolutely. But you can see that it served a purpose, whether you agree with the purpose or not. And quite a few monster legends have done that over the years. They've fulfilled a role. They've met a requirement that people have had. So another good example is the stories of devil dogs, you know, these black demonic dogs that are prevalent on the south coast of England, with glowing red eyes, the hellhounds to all intents and purposes. These stories were often started by smugglers who wanted to keep people clear of a particular stretch of the coastline so they could bring their liquor ashore undisturbed at night.
Isn't that fascinating? Wow. So now, what would you say is the, of the 17 monsters you highlight in your book, what would you say has the greatest chance of existence based on your research and any recorded experiences?
That is a fantastic question. I mean, some of them invariably exist, but they are not necessarily what we think they are. So, for example, I talk about the chupacabra, you know, the so-called ghost sucker. there are some excellent hypotheses made that the Chupacabra is in fact a coyote with mange, which is a disease which, you know, scabs off the hair, gives them a very monstrous appearance. So I think there's a lot of evidence that the Chupacabra is real, but not what we think it is. So that's the key, right? I don't know that any of these exist in the form that they are commonly believed to exist in. So another good example is the werewolf. Clinical lycanthropy is a real condition. But what it is, crucially, is not somebody who physically changes into a wolf. It is a person who believes, who is utterly convinced in their heart and soul that they are a wolf. So werewolves are real, but there is no physical transformation involved. The same is true with vampirism. There are many people out there who live the lifestyle of a vampire. They don't actually grow fangs. They're certainly not able to change into a bat or anything of that nature, or a swarm of bats. But they are vampires, you know. So it's, again, that's a very blurred.
Do you feel that there are cultural differences that, you know, maybe, like, for example, the European ancestry have their own interpretations of some, you know, the monsters? You know, is there, have you found anything, you know, culturally specific, or, you know, that any particular culture? Okay, can you give us an example?
Absolutely. I mean, sticking with vampires, you know, I've already mentioned that our, in the Western world, our perception of vampires is a very specific one. If you go to the Philippines, they have what's called the Manangal, which is like a big bat-winged vampire. So it's a human torso with arms, but no legs. Its upper body, its torso at the waistline, separates from its legs. It sprouts bat wings, and it flies through the night sucking blood out of its victims, you know. And I know this sounds fantastical. It sounds like the sort of thing we ought to expect to find in old books. But there was a murder case which took place. Somebody believed they were murdering one of these creatures in the Philippines, and it took place in 2011. You know,
wow.
the most recent newspaper sightings from the Philippines of one of these flying monsters. 2023, so just, you know, 2 years ago. And so, you know, culturally, their vampires look very different than ours. If you go to India, the Indians have the Chedape, which is a vampire woman who rides through the night on the back of a tiger, goes into men's houses and sucks blood out of the male, sleeping male's toes. That's very, very different to Bela Lugosi and his cape, you know.
That's very different and yeah. Very specific, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the Chedape are interesting because the stories began that, you know, they would not only suck blood from males like this, but they would have sexual intercourse with males with the intent of causing, like, marital discord in the household and stress. And you just have to look at that legend and go, how many men use this as a get-out-of-jail-free card, you know?
I know. That would be, I guess, an excellent excuse, so to speak,
you'll,
for any kind of alien.
You'll never believe this, dear, but it was a vampire.
Oh, how funny. Now, which of those that you highlighted in your book do you feel is the least likely to exist based on, you know, your research and experience?
Yeah, I absolutely fell in love with them all, but the Jersey Devil is the one I think that is almost certainly fiction, despite the many stories and the fact that this is such a beloved creature in New Jersey. I think the Jersey Devil is 100% folklore. That being said, there are still Jersey Devil sightings. You know, they show up on the news. I found accounts from within the last few years of people that claim to have seen this bat-winged, flying, goat-headed creature around New Jersey. So who knows? But I think the evidence for it is very flimsy.
Yeah. Okay. And out of those that you highlight in your book, what would you say, which one maybe surprised you the most when you were going through your research for the book?
What surprised me the most? What I found most surprising was, I talked about zombies, you know, the undead, the living dead. I was able to explore the cultural connotations of that, the fact that, you know, Haiti and the Haitian culture has a strong belief in zombies, and it's part of the voodoo tradition. But I had no idea, and this absolutely blew me away, that the U.S. Army came up with in just 10 years ago, 15 years ago, a zombie uprising defense plan. It was done as a training exercise, but the U.S. Army actually came up with what was called CONPLAN 8888, which was how the U.S. military would respond to a zombie apocalypse.
Wow. I guess the government never ceases to amaze.
There was actually a good reason for it, to be fair. It was done, I'm an educator myself, so I respect the way this happened, but it was done as a way of engaging some officers' imaginations in terms of how they would develop war plans. The military was getting a lot of criticism at the time because their training exercises would usually involve some kind of nation that was a very thinly veiled, fictionalized version of a real country, you know? So they develop an invasion plan of, say, Zombiestan. And they got a lot of criticism for it. So they said, we need to come up with a war plan for an enemy that nobody could say, hey, you know, we're planning to take over a European country or a neighboring country or whatever. Everybody can agree that zombies are not the good guys. So it was an imaginative training framework for American military planners to hone their skills. How would we, our military, tackle an uprising of the undead, which I thought was terrific.
Yeah, well, you know, it is interesting that something like that would spur the creative musings in someone, and particularly if we're talking about the services, you know, and having to come up with plans, it really kind of takes it into a realm that, they would normally not consider.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it, again, it comes back to our monsters having a role, having, you know, meeting a need, serving a cause. I'm sure nobody ever thought zombies would be fulfilling that need, but it definitely had value. And if you want to read that plan, by the way, you can read it. It is out there on the internet. So it makes a very interesting reading.
So now, what do you hope that the readers are going to take away from reading Monsters, Myths, Legends, and Real Encounters?
My main hope, I grew up reading books about monsters, and I'm definitely following trails that were blazed by other researchers and authors. My real profound hope for this book is that anybody that reads it, number one, enjoys it, but finds something in here that makes them want to go explore the work of researchers that have devoted their entire lives to following some of these monsters, you know. I co-authored a book on Mothman with Tobias Wayland, and I hope that that book sends people reading about John Keel and some of the things he put out there. But there are some excellent books about Bigfoot, Sasquatch, the Loch Ness Monster, vampirism, you name it, that go so far in depth on all these subjects. I hope readers are inspired to go learn more for themselves.
And one thing I noticed, not every book has, but you do, is that you have a wonderful index in the back of the book for further reading for people who really want to explore the topic any further. And that's great because it, your book is a launching pad for that kind of inquiry.
That's my hope, you know, and there are many authors on this list, like Nick Redfern, who have written extensively in the field, Brad Steiger, so many others, and we're all standing on their shoulders, those of us that are following in their footsteps today. So I do hope that further reading is a good starting point for some of the readers of this book.
And also you have an index, too. That's great. You know, that's a wonderful way for people to take a book and subject and be able to kind of further explore, you know, whatever type of subject or monster really interests them, that it really gives them a good way to, it points the way to further study.
That is my hope. So if I achieve that aim, I'll be a very happy author.
Great. Well, Richard, this has really been a wonderful time chatting with you. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me. And again, I love your book. It's one of those that you can read that's not only thought-provoking, but also entertaining. You know, and so many times the books that we read just don't have that entertainment kind of component, and yours does.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. That if I manage to entertain and inform, then I will have done my job, and I'll be very content.
You did. So, again, everyone, today my special guest has been Richard Estep, author of Monsters, Myths, Legends, and Real Encounters. And again, you can find out more about all he has to offer by visiting his website, which is www.richardestep.net. And that's Richard, ESTEP.net. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.